And we looked at capital D, that in advancing their arguments for developments, the critics overlooked definite evidences against them. We discussed Deuteronomy 27 together as number one, and as number two, Joshua 22, I asked you to study the passage and see whether you feel that it contradicts the arguments for development. Now, that was D. Then I believe I mentioned E, didn't I? General conclusions regarding development of religious institutions within the document. And I mentioned again there as one, in parenthesis, as already noted, there is only one important instance where as many as three stages are claimed. Then that was one. Two, many of the alleged differences are caused by reading something into the text and rest heavily upon arguments from science. Yes? Well, I thought it would be rather clear, but if there are any questions on it, I'd be glad to discuss them. Is it clear to everybody, or does anybody have questions? I think there is this about it, that it overlaps a little bit with the next argument, the argument from history. Because after all, well, it might be put in either place, because the critics claim, most of them, at least they did a very short time ago, that we have not a Pentateuch but a Hexateuch. And the documents are found in Joshua. But there's far less agreement among them as to the documents in Joshua than as to them in the other books. Well, now, this Joshua 22 is a part of Joshua, which the critics divide up among the same documents as they do the other. On the other hand, if you think of it as a Pentateuch and Joshua as being the first book of history, then what you find in Joshua 22 might be considered an argument from history rather than development within the document. So that I think perhaps if there's anything about it that isn't altogether clear to you, you might bring it up under the argument from history. We'll probably touch upon it some there. But it also belongs in this place. So I have it listed here in the notes. Thank you for mentioning that. I think it is good to clarify that. Mr. Lee?
The 19th volunteer of the Greek Yes, the work at that time was already in Jerusalem. I mean, the sacrifices were already in Jerusalem. That's the main point.
Sort of near, but not exactly. That is the point. The point here is that according to the book of Joshua, it was felt at that time that there was one place where sacrifice should be and only one. Now, Jerusalem was not conquered until some centuries later when David conquered. So that there's no mention of Jerusalem in the Pentateuch at all, except the mention of Melchizedek as son of, as king of Salem. But be careful that it's the place, one place to be selected rather than Jerusalem specifically. The critical claim is that it was the Jerusalem priests who got this put through. But they knew Jerusalem had not been the place until the time of David. So they make it the whatever place the Lord would choose. And before Jerusalem, it had been Shiloh, which was conquered by the Philistines and destroyed. But that is getting into the history, but the question again helps to clarify, and I'm glad for it. Now, we mentioned then, too, many of the alleged differences are caused by reading something into the text. We noticed two or three cases that you will find a great many. And rest heavily upon arguments from science. Number three, such differences as exist can be readily explained by the history of the time of Moses, and do not require a theory of development over long periods of time. This summarizes material we have looked at. It is tremendously important. So much for capital E. Then capital F. A considerable number of critical scholars, now hold that P was written before D, and thus overthrow the whole structure of the development idea. I think that they people have accepted the ideas of the documents, the idea of development. They take it all as proven. Then they start in trying to examine particular points to make it, work it out more exactly in relation to the data in the Bible. And next you know, you find them twisting some points that are actually fundamental to the theory, which if they are to be changed, then properly the whole theory should be re-examined. One of the basic things in the whole Wellhausen theory is that P comes after D, and while questions of development from J to E are very vague and there's very little can be proven in that line, it's really three main lines, J, E, and then D, and then P. If you take P and put it back before D, you upset the whole development. And yet William F. Albright, professor in Johns Hopkins University, now emeritus, but for many years a very outstanding leader in archaeological study and a man who holds firmly to the basic points of the Grosse-Wellhausen theory, has spoken out very strongly that P, the priestly code, was written before the book of Deuteronomy. And it's very interesting that a book was written about 10 years ago by a man named B.W. Anderson, Bernard Anderson, who was then professor in Drew University, a Methodist theological seminary in New Jersey, but who has in recent years become professor in Princeton Theological Seminary. This book called Understanding the Old Testament, I have mentioned to you before, it is used as a textbook in hundreds, according to its publisher's claims, in hundreds of American universities and colleges. And in this book, he presents the Grosse-Wellhausen theory as established fact. And simply tells you how these things developed, and it's given in quite an interesting style and has had a wide influence. There was a new edition of it published about 3 years ago. And the new edition is very, very similar to the old edition. There are comparatively few places where the words are changed at all. I brought both the old and new edition to class with me at our last meeting, thinking I might read you one page from the two editions. One of the places where changes took place, which struck me as very interesting. That in the original edition of it, where he tells about the putting together of the Pentateuch, he tells how the priestly history was combined with J and E. So you had J, E, P, and then later it was combined with the book of Deuteronomy. And in the new edition of it, that particular page, though half the words on the page are identical to those in the first edition, he simply reverses that and says that that J and E were united with the book of Deuteronomy, and then later on that the priestly history was united with them, making it J-E-D-P. Now, it seems to me that's an interesting instance of a case where a man looking at it himself from simply a logical view without thinking very deeply about the origin of the Grosse-Wellhausen theory, noticed that according to the critical theory, the first four books of the Pentateuch are really made up of J, of parts the critics call J and E and P. And there's very little in the first four books that they would call D. And that P, of course, is the basic structure of the book of Genesis. It has the heading for most of the sections. It has the basic structure. And according to the critical theory, J and E have been inserted into P in the book of Genesis. But the book of Deuteronomy is pretty much a separate entity, even though there are parts of it they say are from P and parts they say are from J and E. Most of it they consider as being the document D, to which they give very, very little in the previous four books. And so from simply a natural view of partition, assuming there's partition, it would be more natural to say J, E, and P were put together and then D was that. And he simply did that in his first edition. But then, in between the first edition and the second edition, he must have come to realize that to make this change, to do it in this way, really undermines the whole development theory upon which the Groff-Wellhausen view was based and which had so much influence in its being so widely adopted about 80 years ago. And in this edition, without any word that there's any vital change, he simply reverts to the old theory and gives it dogmatic. Most of those who hold to the Groff-Wellhausen theory have to hold. It's J, E, D, and P is the order, because the theory was based upon this idea of development among the documents, with P representing a later state. Just think from this viewpoint of the place of sacrifice. According to the critical theory, J and E, you can sacrifice anywhere. You sacrifice all around, many places. But then, D lays down a definite law. You're to sacrifice only in one place. And then P assumes that you sacrifice only in one place. Here you have a development, a progress. But now just change the order of the last two and see how little sense it makes. J and E assume you can sacrifice in many places. P assumes you sacrifice only in one place. And then after you have P, then D lays down a law, you've got to sacrifice only in one place. You see, it's not logical at all in relation to that. And the same thing is true in relation to the people who perform the sacrifice. According to their claim, any head of a family in J and E, in D, only the Levites, and in P, only the members of the family of Aaron. Now, to hold that it was any head of a family, then it was limited to members of the family of Aaron. And then they forget all about the family of Aaron, and it's limited to the Levites. It breaks up the whole developmental structure. And yet, scholars like B.W. Anderson in the first edition of his book, used so widely, and outstanding archaeologists like Albright, very dogmatically say that P must have been written before D. So this is an interesting point in this connection. And I believe that with that point we can go on to Roman numeral 14. Yes?
Did you find anyone else besides Albright and Anderson?
At the moment, no, I can't. But there are a great many writings and articles and discussions on these matters. And it's my impression you wouldn't have difficulty in finding some others who would speak along the same way, though I doubt if they would be as dogmatic as these two have been. In fact, lesser men than these two would hesitate about being quite so dogmatic, because after all, they're going against the main points of the established theory. Yes?
Dr. Common in a Hebrew university wrote that Hebrew 14.
What was his name again?
Kaufman.
Dr. Kaufman in the Hebrew university. Yes, that D was before P. The P was before D. Yes. Yes, very interesting. There's another instance for you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, Roman numeral 14 is the argument from history. The argument from history. Now, this argument, the argument from history, is the strongest argument, actually, in the whole developmental phase of the Groff-Wellhausen theory, is the argument from history. It is far more difficult to answer than the one we have just been looking at, the idea of development within the document. It and the argument from parallel passages are the two strongest phases of their argument. And I would think that 30 years ago, it would be extremely important to be well-versed in the evidence on this. Today, the whole development aspect is not stressed nearly as much as the partition aspect is stressed. I think many people do not realize how much the two are interdependent. And the partition theory being so dogmatically presented as established fact in, most places where the Bible is taught now, it is assumed as a fundamental fact, and you can begin tinkering with it and changing it around here and there, not worry so much about it. And when it comes to development, development theories, there's been much variety in thinking about it, where a great many people throw up their hands and say we don't really know how things have developed. And so today the stress is much more on the partition argument than it is on the development argument. Yet we never know how these things are going to swing. And if there should come a really powerful attack against the Gross-Bellhausen theory, it would seem probable that then there would be a great movement in its defense to stress again the arguments upon which it was established. And certainly one of those, a great part of that, was the developmental phase of the argument. And in that, the one which can be made to appear by far the strongest is the evidence from history. The book which caused the Gross-Bellhausen theory to receive such great acceptation in Europe and America was Bellhausen's book, which he called originally History of Israel, Volume 1. But then he never wrote a Volume 2, so the next edition they called it Prolegomena to the History of Israel. And it has since gone by that name, Prolegomena. It has been translated several times into English. It's strange that his book, Composition of the Hexateuch, so far as I know, which goes into the details of the various documents, so far as I know, has never been translated into English. At least I've never seen a translation, and I have looked a certain amount for one. I've only seen it in the German. He goes into great detail to which verses apply belong to which documents in that. As far as I know, it's never been translated into English, but his Prolegomena to the History of Israel has been translated into two or three different translations. And occasionally I have seen arguments against the Bellhausen theory presented by fundamentalist writers, some men of considerable scholarship who have given quotations from Bellhausen's Prolegomena, which I have been unable to find. And I think that is due to different translations and different editions. I think they doubtless found what they gave, but I have not been able to find in the particular editions that I have. But it shows the great influence the book has. Now, the subject, the title, Prolegomena to the History of Israel, is quite different from a title, Composition of the Hexateuch. And draws attention to the fact that that which caused it to win great acceptation was his claim to show how Israelite institutions, how Israelite history actually developed. And he claimed that you could find out how it developed by seeing how these documents were in the completely changed order from that which the older theories had held, and by seeing how this fit with the course of history. That is to say, that the laws of Deuteronomy are not found to have any place in the history before the time of Josiah. And that the peculiar institutions of peace, that is, the elaborate ritual of peace, the elaborate system of sacrifices and of conduct of the priesthood and the temple and all that, did not even exist before the Exodus. And as proof of that, he goes into the various historical books and endeavors to show that in the historical books you just do not have evidence of sacrifice being limited to one place until the time of Deuteronomy, or of it being limited to the Levites before the time of Deuteronomy, and that you don't have evidence of it being limited to the family of Aaron until after the Exodus. That, you see, is the argument. And that, if it can be proven, is a tremendous argument. But, of course, in proving a thing like that, we have to ask the question, how probable is it that we would have evidence of it in our history? How sure can we be, when the history doesn't mention something, that actually did not occur, that thing was not there. Now, you go to most funerals, and this country, and I believe at least most I've ever been to, as the body is put into the earth, they say ashes to ashes, dust to dust. There's certain formulae like that that you will nearly always hear. Recite it. It is a rather established custom in relation to funerals. Now you pick up a history of the United States, even a very detailed history of the United States during this past 100 years. And you might nowhere find in it any reference to that formula being used at a funeral. You might find mentions of the funerals of some of our famous men and the great crowds that came and the people who spoke. But there might be no mention of this formula having been used, but that wouldn't prove that it hadn't been used. You see what I mean? There is a great danger in this sort of an argument of assuming that silence on something means it didn't exist, when it may merely mean that the sources we have do not tell about it. It's like Marco Polo. I think I've already mentioned before how Marco Polo tells a great deal about the wonderful thing he found in China, that they had paper money. And he was so thrilled about this, not having to carry around the whole cartload of metal in order to pay for something, but having paper money. But he never mentions the fact that they had printing in China. He didn't even notice that. And yet the paper money was printed. And for any of us today, when we think of the part printing plays in our lives, it would seem far more important to us to have printing than to have paper money. But he didn't think it. I suppose he got used to it there, and he didn't realize how strange it was compared to anything they had in Europe at that time, which in that regard was so very backward then as compared with China. And he did not mention that particular fact. Now, however, the critical argument here does not rest strictly upon silence. It also has many definite statements to which it refers. Now, they do not claim there's a statement. The law of D had not yet been established at this time. Priesthood was not yet limited to the family of Aaron. Any statement like that, they do not claim. But they do claim that there are many statements which show people acting in complete disregard of the law of Deuteronomy, or the law of peace, which they say is evidence that these laws did not exist at this time. I have here the composition of the Hexateuch by Carpenter, which goes at some length into this argument. I have here a book published very recently by G.W. Anderson, not B.W., the man in Princeton, but this is a professor in Edinburgh, Scotland, G.W. Anderson, A Critical Introduction to the Old Testament, first published in 1959 and reprinted several times since. And he says in here that the main arguments in support of the critical position here are as follows. Deuteronomy forbids sacrificial worship except one central sanctuary. The laws in J and E appear to know nothing of such a prohibition. The historical narrative seems to show that in the time of the judges and the early monarchy, pious Israelites like Samuel and Elijah knew nothing of it either, since they offered sacrifice and even erected altars in various parts of the country. This gives the impression that this law was unknown during the greater part of the period of the monarchy. And the evidence laid on the emphasis laid on the law in Deuteronomy does suggest that it is comparatively new. Again, in Deuteronomy, priests and Levites are identified. All priests are Levites, and all Levites are priests. This identification is not made in J or E. Incidentally, it's not made in D either. He is speaking way beyond the facts when he says all priests are Levites and all Levites are priests. He speaks of the Levitical priesthood frequently, but that doesn't prove all Levites are priests and all priests Levites. He says this identification is not made in J or E. And again, in the historical narratives of the period of the judges and the early monarchy, we find that although it may have been desirable that a priest should be a Levite, it was by no means essential. He gives references, Judges 17:5, 2 Samuel 8:18, and 20:26. Now let's look for a minute at the first of these, Judges 17. He says, Judges 17:5, it was by no means essential that a priest should be a Levite. Now Judges 17 says, and there was a man of Mount Ephraim whose name was Micah, and he said to his mother, the 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from thee, about which thou cursedst and spakest up also in mine ears, behold, the silver is with me. I took it. And his mother said, blessed be thou of the Lord, my son. Very forgiving mother, wasn't she? And when he had restored the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, I had wholly dedicated the silver unto the Lord from my hand for my son to make a graven image and a molten image. And now, therefore, I will restore it unto thee. Yet he restored the money unto his mother, and his mother took 200 shekels of silver and gave them to the founder and made thereof a graven image and a molten image. And they were in the house of Micah. And the man Micah had an house of God and made an ephod and teraphim and consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. In those days there was no king in Israel, but every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Now that is the reference for the statement that at this time, though it may have been desirable a priest should be a Levite, it was by no means essential. Well, after the Ten Commandments so strictly forbid making molten images or observing idolatry like that, then for this man Micah to take his son and consecrate him to be a priest, to serve before a molten image which he had made, is certainly no evidence at all that the law of Deuteronomy and of the so-called priestly, yeah, the law of Deuteronomy was not known at that time. And it is very wise when you read one of the critical books, when you find a reference given like this, look up the reference. Don't just take for granted that the reference must prove it or he wouldn't give it. Look it up. It was a few years ago, I received a letter from a young woman who was in Westchester Teachers College. And she wrote me and she said, we are required to attend a course here called the History of Western Civilization. And she said, in this course, we have a certain book as textbook, and the professor doesn't seem to know a great deal about it except what the textbook says. And when we raise a question, he allows us to talk. But she said, reading what's in the book, we're very much confused. Wonder if you could come down and speak at a church near the place and tell us something about it. I said, well, send me a copy of the book to look over and I'll be glad to do it. So she did. She mailed me her copy. I looked through it. I went down. She said, I'll announce it in class and maybe the professor himself will come. So he didn't. But we had a considerable group from the class who came. And we discussed the book at some length. And the book showed the history of the developing ideas of religion in different periods as reflected in the Old Testament. And in one place it said, the second Isaiah has an idea of God, a God who is so remote and so distant that he has no interest in what human beings at all. And he even says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways. You see how completely that shows that the idea of the second Isaiah is a God who is not interested in humanity at all. Now, of course, that's verse 8 of Isaiah 55, and if the professor who wrote the book, a professor in Rutgers University, if he had bothered to read verse 7, it seems to me he must have simply taken the statement from some other book. Because if he'd bother to read verse 7, let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts, and let him return to the Lord, and he will have mercy upon him. And to our God, for he will abundantly pardon, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither my ways your ways. The Lord says, I'm not like you people that hold a grudge no matter what a person does and are implacable. He says, if you will forsake your wicked ways and turn to the Lord, I will forgive you, because my ways are not your ways and my thoughts not your thoughts. The exact opposite of what this very attractive book put out by one of our leading textbook publishers, and probably uses a textbook in many colleges, simply presented as a fact, and doubtless misled a great many students. I found a number of other similar matters in the book. And it really is shocking when you see how people can utterly misuse scripture passages and other people swallow it, because there is a tremendous ignorance of the Bible in our day. Tremendous ignorance. Some would even think this Micah that I was just reading about had something to do with the prophet Micah, who of course lived many centuries later and was an utterly different type of person from this wicked Micah, whom Anderson here uses as evidence that the laws of Deuteronomy were at that time unknown. Now, a carpenter, the composition of the Hexateuch, we have referred to a good many times, and on page 132 to 134, he has a section he calls the Testimony of History. And starting on page 133, he says, prior to the Jerusalem temple, there is no trace of any exclusively authorized sanctuary. The Mosaic tent is fixed at Shiloh, Joshua 18:1, but there is even in Joshua's time a holy place at Shechem with its solemn stones and oak in its enclosure, where a national assembly is held, a covenant is made, and laws are issued. It is sufficient to point out that sacrifice might be offered in almost any spot, and for sacrifice an altar of some sort was indispensable. The country was covered with sacred places, many of them doubtless connected with the cultus of the Canaanite occupants, at which the Israelites soon learned to worship. Such was the great high place at Gibeon, 1 Kings 3:4, one of a small group of Canaanite towns which retained their independence till after the monarchy had been established. Such probably was the Gilgal or stone circle near Jericho. Others were founded by the new settlers. Gideon built an altar at Ophrah and devoted a portion of the Midianite booty to his sanctuary. The Danites plant themselves with the grandson of Moses for their priest in the far north. The boy Samuel is dedicated to the service of the house of Yahweh at Shiloh. This is no wandering tent. It is a stationary temple, 1 Samuel 1:9. And he goes, well, a little further down, he says, in the Shiloh temple, Samuel himself, no Levite, still less priest, sleeps in the chamber of the ark. And in after days, he ministers at the high place at Ramah, his own home. He gives references by most of these states. Sacrifice is equally legitimate upon a rock, Judges 6:20, or on an extemporized altar in the open field, 1 Samuel 6:14, 14:35. Further on, he says, even after the removal of the ark to Zion, the rite of sacrifice elsewhere is still open in the neighborhood of Jerusalem. David offers the oxen on a round of threshing floor, 2 Samuel 24:25. And when Adonijah prepared to claim the succession, he is supported by the priest Abiathar in a festive sacrifice at the serpent stone beside the fuller's well, 1 Kings 1:7 and 9. A public act which could not have been done if it would involve a flagrant violation of sacred law, likely to prejudice his bid for the throne. The Deuteronomic demand for a single sanctuary being thus unrecognized, it is not surprising to find Levitical principles ignored or defied with equal regularity and persistence. Whatever may be the early history of the tribe of Levi, and no branch of the history of Israel is more obscure, it appears plain that religious usage in the age immediately following the settlement is entirely unconscious of the requirements of the priestly code. There is no trace of any exclusive sacred order. The chief authority is civil, not ecclesiastical. All through the main narrative of Judges 3 to 16, there's no mention of professional priests. Gideon and Manoah sacrificed after the fashion of the patriarchs of elder time. A wealthy Ephraimite who piously establishes a household sanctuary, installs one of his own sons as priest. This is the one we read a few months ago about this Micah. Even the wandering Levite, whom he engages on a small annual stipend of 10 pieces of silver, a suit of clothes, and his board, was not of Aaronic descent. At Shiloh, the priesthood has become hereditary in Eli's family, but a youth from another tribe is admitted into the sanctuary, and in defiance of all Levitical prescriptions, sleeps beside the ark. And he goes on. Samuel conducts sacrifice regularly at Ramah and frequently elsewhere, as at Mizpah, Bethlehem, and Gilgal. And Saul does the same. Over the family sacrifice, once a year at Bethlehem, Jesse or some other elder probably presided. And so on. So you see, there are, of course, later on he'll come to mention Elijah rebuilding the altar and sacrificing on it there, as you remember, when the Lord himself sent down the fire to light the sacrifice up on Mount Carmel, not at Jerusalem at all. So I've read just enough of the statements of these men to give an idea how much material there is that they present as evidence in connection with this argument from history. Now we want to look at these evidences about this argument from history. And so we will call capital A, survey of alleged violations of law, of the law of the place of sanctuary. Survey of alleged violations of the law of the place of sacrifice. Now the first of these is Mount Ebal, Joshua 8, 30-32. You remember there that in Joshua 8 they were told to build this altar at Mount Ebal, and there they are to write the law on the altar, and they are to recite the blessings and the curses. Next is the case of Manoah. Now you remember that Manoah is the father of Samson. This is Judges 6:11. Or no, Gideon. Rather, Gideon comes before Manoah. Gideon is in Judges 6:11. There we find that there came an angel of the Lord and sat under an oak which was in Ophrah that pertained to Joash the Abiezrite, and his son Gideon threshed wheat by the winepress to hide it from the Midianites. And this angel talked to Gideon. And then we read in verse 19, Gideon went in and made ready a kid and unleavened cakes of an ephah of flour. The flesh he put in a basket, and he put the broth in a pot and brought it out unto the oak and presented it. And the angel of God said to him, take the flesh and the unleavened cakes and lay them upon this rock and pour out the broth. And he did so. Then the angel of the Lord put forth the end of the staff that was in his hand and touched the flesh and the unleavened cake, and there rose up fire out of the rock and consumed the flesh and the unleavened cakes. Well, would this angel have done this if the book of Deuteronomy had already been written and said the sacrifice was to be confined to the one place the Lord would choose? Would the angel have done this if Deuteronomy had already said that it must be performed by Levites? Was the angel a Levite? Then we have the case of Manoah, which is Judges 13. I trust most of you recall that Manoah is the father of Samson. And we read there in Judges 13, verse 15. Well, I guess we better start a little bit before that. For context, there was this Manoah, an angel of the Lord, verse 3, appeared to the woman and said, behold, thou art barren, bearest not, but thou shalt conceive and bear a son. And he's to be a Nazarite. And then the woman told her husband, and verse 8, Manoah entreated the Lord and said, O my Lord, let the man of God whom thou didst send come again unto me and teach us what we shall do unto the child that shall be born. And God hearkened to the voice of Manoah, and the angel of God came again unto the woman as she sat in the field. But Manoah, her husband, was not with her. And the woman made haste and ran and showed her husband and said to him, Behold, the man hath appeared to me that came to me the other day. And Manoah arose and went after his wife and came to the man and said to him, Art thou the man that spakest unto the woman? And he said, I am. And Manoah said, Now let thy words come to pass. How shall we order the child and how shall we do unto him? And the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, Of all that I said to the woman, let her beware that the child is not to touch wine or strong drink or eat any unclean thing. And Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, I pray thee, let us detain thee till we shall have made ready a kid for thee. And the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, though thou detain me, I will not eat of thy bread. And if thou offer a burnt offering, thou must offer it unto the Lord. For Manoah knew not that he was an angel of the Lord. And Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, What is thy name, that when thy sayings come to pass, we may do thee honor? And the angel of the Lord said unto him, What maketh, why askest thou after my name, seeing it is secret? So Manoah took a kid with a meat offering and offered it upon a rock unto the Lord. And the angel did wondrously, and Manoah and his wife looked on. For it came to pass, when the flame went up toward heaven from off the altar, that the angel of the Lord ascended in the flame of the altar. And Manoah and his wife looked on it and fell on their faces to the ground. But the angel of the Lord did no more appear to Manoah and to his wife. Then Manoah knew that he was an angel of the Lord. And Manoah said to his wife, We shall surely die because we've seen God. But his wife said to him, If the Lord was pleased to kill us, he would not have received the burnt offering and the meat offering at our hands. Neither would he have showed us all these things. And the woman bare a son and called his name Samson. Now in this account here, there's no mention that you must go to Jerusalem or to Shiloh, somewhere else, and offer your sacrifice. The angel accepts sacrifice right there. And Manoah, it says, was of the Danites. It does not say that he was a Levite. Would such an account have been written if the book of Deuteronomy was already in existence? Now we get to Samuel. And we have Samuel mentioned as, I think all this stress on Samuel sleeping in the sanctuary and that sort of thing is rather beside the point. But we do have Samuel offering sacrifice at various places. He goes about and he holds sacrifices at various places. That is definitely stated. And that is certainly a point very much of importance in this connection. Now we have Saul. And Saul we find in 1 Samuel 14:35. If I don't misread my note here. Is Saul, yes. In 1 Samuel 14, we have a case where Saul gives an order that no one is to eat anything until the battle has been won. But Jonathan eats a little honey that they find. And then we read in verse 31, they smote the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ajalon. The people were very faint, and the people flew upon the spoil and took sheep and oxen and calves and slew them on the ground. And the people did eat them with the blood. Then they told Saul, saying, Behold, the people sin against the Lord in that they eat with the blood. And he said, Ye have transgressed. Roll a great stone unto me this day. And Saul said, Disperse yourselves among the people and say unto them, Bring me hither every man his ox and every man his sheep. His sheep, and slay them here and eat, and sin not against the Lord in eating with the blood. And all the people brought every man his ox with him that night and slew them there. And Saul built an altar unto the Lord, which was the first altar that he built unto the Lord. Then we find Saul again in chapter 15, verse 21, where we find that Saul said to Samuel, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and gone the way the Lord sent me and have brought Agag, the king of Amalek, and utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took of the spoil sheep and oxen the chief of the things which should have been utterly destroyed, to sacrifice unto the Lord thy God in Gilgal. Doesn't say in Shiloh or in Jerusalem, says in Gilgal. And Samuel said, has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifice as obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice. He doesn't say, how wicked the sacrifice in Gilgal. They should have gone back to Shiloh or gone to Jerusalem. He says to obey is better than sacrifice. Then we find David bringing up the ark in 2 Samuel. In 2 Samuel 6. You remember that first David tried to bring the ark, and they had brought it in the wrong way, and the Lord had smitten the man dead who tried to hold it. And so they left it in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, 3 months. And then we read in verse 12 following how David brought the ark up to Jerusalem. And it says in verse 13, when they that bare the ark had gone 6 paces, he sacrificed oxen and fatlings. They would go a certain distance and then they would make a sacrifice. And they'd go a certain distance further and make a sacrifice. And he sacrificed. Is this David? Was David a Levite? Did they even know about the law of Deuteronomy at this time? Did they even know about the law of peace? Then another instance they point to is the case of Adonijah. I trust that you all remember that Adonijah was one of the older sons of David, who many people thought should be king after David. And when David was old and was not doing much anymore, people were afraid that when he died, there would be a big war as to who would succeed him. And so they selected Adonijah, and they held a big meeting in order to make Adonijah king. And so in verse 9 we read, after they invited all these people and went out there near Jerusalem, Adonijah slew sheep and oxen and fat cattle by the stone of Zoar, which is by Enrail, and called all his brethren, the king's sons, and all the men of Judah, the king's servants. Yes? This is 1 Kings 1:9. 1 Kings 1:9. And now a very interesting case is the case of Samuel. We find that Solomon. We spoke about Samuel already. We find that Solomon became king. Adonijah was killed. And Solomon, we read in 1 Kings 3, we read, in verse 3, and Solomon, let's start at the beginning, chapter 3. And Solomon made affinity with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her to the city of David, until he had made an end of building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall of Jerusalem round about. Only the people sacrificed in high places, because there was no house built unto the name of the Lord until those days. And Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of David his father, only he sacrificed and burnt incense in high places. These references, only he sacrificed burnt offerings in high places, they say those are Deuteronomic additions, that the original history does not contain those statements, but that the putting of them in recognizes that he did not yet know the Deuteronomic law. And the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there. For that was the great high place. 1,000 burnt offerings did Solomon offer upon that altar. He went to Gibeon. He offered 1,000 burnt offerings on the great altar. And did God say, Solomon, you have broken the law. It's supposed to be sacrifices only in Jerusalem. You've gone to Gibeon a few miles north of Jerusalem. Only priests are supposed to offer sacrifice. You're not a priest, Solomon. You're not even of the tribe of Levi, but you have offered 1,000 burnt offerings, 1,000 cows Solomon put on the altar and killed and sacrificed to the Lord. Did the Lord rebuke him strongly for it? We read that verse 3, verse 5, in Gibeon the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, ask what I shall give thee. Doesn't sound like rebuke, does it? Ask what I shall give thee. Then Solomon said, thou hast showed thy servant David, John, and he gave his prayer that he would give him understanding and wisdom, and God gave it to him. There's no rebuke to Solomon there at all. Well, was the law of the one place of sacrifice broken by these, and by Elijah, of course, and other places might be mentioned? Does that prove that Deuteronomy was not yet written? Well, the law of the one place of sacrifice is in Deuteronomy 12, and it is very important to know exactly what that law is. So please, before tomorrow, read Deuteronomy 12 and see exactly what the law of one place for sacrifice is according to Deuteronomy. And we'll continue there tomorrow.